Well, thank you, and thank you very much to the organizers for the invitation. After the last several talks, I only need to give a very brief introduction to probes of neutrino mass. I'll then describe the principles of actually measuring a spectrum from radioactive decay, followed by some of the theoretical challenges involved in extracting a neutrino mass value from such a spectrum. Of course, there are experimental challenges as well, and I'll share a few of those before giving you a sense of the landscape of direct neutrino mass measurements over the next several years. So we know that there are a number of different experimental approaches that access different neutrino mass observables. So for example, neutrino oscillation experiments give information about the mass splitting, but not information about the absolute mass scale, or the mass of the lightest neutrino. We've recently heard that neutrinoless double beta decay accesses this effective mass term, which does depend on the neutrino mass eigenstates, M sub I. But extracting that M sub I information requires information about the Majorana phases, the nuclear matrix elements, and of course you need lepton number violation to occur in the first place. Cosmological data have given us some exquisite information about the sum of the neutrino mass states, and depending on which data sets you incorporate into setting these limits, you can get a range of limits going down quite low to about 0.1 eV perhaps. But of course, this is a many-parameter model that's used to extract the neutrino mass information. There is some partial degeneracy between parameters, which is why the limit changes depending on which data sets you include. And it's very nice always to have an opportunity to test lambda CDM or some aspect of it in the laboratory. So what we mean by direct measurements is typically from the kinematics of radioactive decay. You're accessing this observable here, which is an incoherent sum of the neutrino mass values M sub I weighted by their coupling to the electron neutrino. The current laboratory limit using this type of measurement is 2 electron volts, and the next generation plans to improve that sensitivity by an order of magnitude, which actually requires doing a factor of 100 better in the experiment, because the observable is actually the mass squared. The nice thing here is that your main theoretical assumption is that conservation of energy holds, and we're usually pretty comfortable with that. So the basic principle is that it's conservation of energy that allows you to extract the neutrino mass. So if you take a look at a typical beta decay, like this one of tritium, and you imagine looking at the very high energy tail of the beta energy spectrum, the shape of that tail is going to be distorted by a non-zero neutrino mass, because that is a packet of energy that the beta cannot carry away. So Fermi made this lovely sketch of what the endpoint shape of the spectrum would look like under various circumstances. And in a modern experiment, not a sketch, you can look at, say, the tritium beta spectrum. You can zoom in on the very, very far endpoint region. And then you can make an exquisitely careful measurement of the spectral shape and extract the neutrino mass value from that shape. So when we talk about beta decay with the emission of a beta and an antineutrino, and I'm going to assume CPT invariance and just use neutrino and antineutrino interchangeably, there are three isotopes that have been in play in this millennium. The main one is tritium with a Q value of 18.6 keV. But there has also been discussion in the literature in the community of rhenium-187 and indium-115, so I'll talk about those very briefly later on. There's one other type of beta decay that can give us information about neutrino mass, and that is electron capture. So I've drawn here a planetary model cartoon of holmium-163. It's missing a lot of electrons, but I hope you get the idea. Of course, the actual atom is not a planetary model. The electrons occupy orbitals. And that means that there's always some probability that you will find an electron inside the nucleus. When that happens, the electron can capture on a proton that transmutes the nucleus, and an electron neutrino is emitted. The daughter atom, of course, is left with a hole in one of the orbitals, and the nuclear charge has suddenly changed. So it's excited, and it emits energy in the form of de-excitation photons, Auger electrons, Coster-Kronig electrons. If you can capture the de-excitation energy, then you can measure a spectrum that looks like this. So here you expect to find resonances at the binding energies of the electrons that might be captured. But just as with your sort of classic beta decay, if you zoom in on the endpoint region of the spectrum, you can see a shape distortion from the presence of a neutrino mass. So here the isotope of choice is holmium-163, which has a fairly low Q value. A low Q value is desirable because it means that fractionally more of your total decays carry useful information about the neutrino mass, that the neutrinos are in this sort of non-relativistic region where their rest mass makes a difference. This plot is from John Wilkerson. It sort of shows the advance of the state-of-the-art direct neutrino mass limits over the years. So the red line is the best value, which is mostly from various types of electromagnetic spectrometers. And the blue line shows advances in colorimetric measurements. We have two more orders of magnitude to go before we hit the floor imposed by oscillations. But once you get below about 0.1 eV, our mass observable can't be expressed in quite this simple way anymore because you start to resolve the splittings, and that changes the way that you need to think about this observable. One thing that I like to note is that people were trying to measure the neutrino mass this way before they had succeeded in measuring the neutrino, and quite a lot of work had been done before a finite neutrino mass was definitively established. So this has excited people for a long time. I'd like to tell you a little bit more about how these excited people can get a measurement of a beta spectrum. The first method that I'd like to describe relates to the spectroscopy of tritium beta decay. And here the idea is to measure an integrated spectrum with a lower threshold of integration, and you can move that threshold in order to map out the shape. How many counts do you see above this beta energy threshold? And the tool of choice for this type of measurement is a MAC-E filter, that's magnetic adiabatic collimation with an electrostatic filter. And you begin by letting your tritium decay in a region of strong magnetic field. The betas are then going to be guided adiabatically along magnetic field lines. And the adiabaticity is important because it makes the magnetic moment a constant of the motion. So here, E perpendicular is the kinetic energy due to motion that's perpendicular to the magnetic field line. So if that's a constant of the motion, that means that as your beta travels from a region of strong magnetic field to a region of weak magnetic field, this central analyzing plane, its momentum is going to rotate to be nearly longitudinal, so that in the middle, in your region of weak magnetic field, you have essentially a very broad collimated beam of electrons that are moving longitudinally. That means that if you impose a longitudinal retarding potential, you have effectively set a threshold on the total beta kinetic energy. By moving this potential, you can then map out the shape of the spectrum. So this was the tool that was used by the Mainz and Troitsk experiments to set the existing best laboratory limit, and it's the tool that will be used by Catrin in the next generation. So let me tell you a little bit more about the Catrin design. This is an engineering drawing of Catrin, which is all that we could show in talks for quite some time. But now all of the major components are actually on site. So you can start with a windowless gaseous tritium source. That's where the decays are designed to happen. You have an electron gun and a rear section for various diagnostic information, and then transport sections for adiabatically guiding electrons through while retaining tritium. And all of those items that I've just described are bolted together in the tritium laboratory section of the experiment. After the transport section is a pre-spectrometer, so that's a low-resolution MAC-E filter that reduces the beta flux through the very large, high-resolution main spectrometer that has an adjustable retarding potential. And then you can count the electrons that make it through to form the integral in a detector system after that. So as built, the design magnetic field will range between 3 and 60,000 Gauss, which gives you an energy resolution better than an electron volt. The source will have some 10 to the 11 decays every second. The partial pressure of tritium will be reduced by a factor of 10 to the 14 between the source and the spectrometers. And all of that should give you a design sensitivity of 0.2 EV at the 90% confidence level. There's also some bonus information that you can get. So any precision beta spectrum measured by anybody, not just by Catrin, is sensitive to new physics. Thierry told us about steroneutrino searches in beta spectra yesterday. And there are also some other interesting ideas like Lorentz invariance violation. Then the Catrin collaboration is also doing some research and development for a possible time of flight type measurement, which would give you a differential spectrum instead of, or complementing an integral spectrum. And this could mitigate the background and improve your statistics. But other than retrofitting Catrin, there is a simpler way to get a differential spectrum, and that's via cyclotron radiation. So we know that an electron in a magnetic field will radiate at a frequency that depends on its kinetic energy. So you can imagine an experiment where you just have tritium decaying in a magnetic field, and you set up a lot of RF antennae, and you pick up the cyclotron frequency and get a spectrum. It turns out that when you try to turn this into an actual experiment, you really want to trap the electrons so that they stick around long enough to radiate some power. But you can measure the entire beta spectrum at once with this method called CRESS, and that's the Project 8 collaboration's goal. So last year, they published a paper with their first krypton 83M spectrum. So krypton 83M is a conversion electron source that's often used for calibration for tritium experiments. So this gives you a sample event. The y-axis is frequency, the x-axis is time, and then the color shows you the signal-to-noise ratio. So you start out with a trapped electron, and you get the energy from its initial frequency right when you first pick it up. In each ramp, you can see the energy loss due to cyclotron radiation, and each step shows that there was some energy loss due to a scattering event. And when you acquire a large number of events like this, you can produce a rather lovely krypton spectrum that looks like that. And in later work, they've managed to attain a energy resolution of 3.6 electron volts. So this really represents a tremendous amount of progress on a very new technique. If your isotope of choice is holmium-163, you need a different strategy, because now you're not looking for the kinetic energy of a single beta, but you're looking to capture all of the de-excitation energy from various different modes. So here, the basic idea is to get a thick, dense absorber, and you can sandwich the holmium-163 inside the absorber. When it decays, the energy is then captured in the absorber and converted into heat, so that if you measure a temperature change in the absorber, you will get the energy from the de-excitation of the daughter dysprosium atom. So to finish your microcalorimeter, you then want to attach a sensitive thermometer. In general, you're looking for very, very small temperature changes. Remember, the endpoint is only 2.8 keV. So in order to reduce noise and improve resolution, you want to translate those temperature changes into magnetic flux changes so that you can read it out with a squid. There are presently three collaborations working in this area using two different thermometry methods. The first one is a transition edge sensor. And the way this works is you take a thin film and you keep it near its superconducting transition temperature. So in that region, the resistance depends very strongly on the temperature. And if you then send a current through it in series with an inductor, you can generate a change in magnetic flux to read out with a nearby squid. So here's a picture of a set of four Holmes detectors. So they use a gold absorber around their holmium-163 and a molybdenum copper transition edge sensor. And in some preliminary work, they've gotten a 4 EV energy resolution with a 6 microsecond rise time, which looks very promising. The NUMEX collaboration is using a very similar idea, but they're The details of their transition edge sensors and absorber designs are a bit different. So they're really, they're not targeting a competitive neutrino mass measurement, but they are very interested in understanding how this type of technology works. So this is a nice spectrum that they published this year, showing the four main resonance peaks in the electron capture spectrum. But their energy resolution is not as good, as you can see. The other approach to a thermometer is a magnetic metallic calorimeter. And here the idea is that you just take a paramagnet and you attach it to the absorber. So when the absorber heats up, this disturbs the magnetization. And again, you can maintain the temperature in a region where you can expect a very steep slope. This is the preferred method of the ECHO collaboration. So you can see a picture of their detector and a spectrum that they took. And in addition to the four main lines that you saw in NUMEX, they're also able to resolve this very low energy O1 line, which is very nice. And they have a very fast rise time, but their energy resolution is about 10 EV, which is also excellent progress. If you had gone to a talk like this 10 years ago, you would probably have heard a lot about rhenium-187 after a successful measurement run by the Mi Beta Neutrino Mass Collaboration. The MARE group was working on R&D for an experiment to compete with Catrin. But they turned out to have a great deal of trouble making practical absorbers containing rhenium. Metallic rhenium turns out to be superconducting at low temperatures, and that makes the thermalization very complex. You can have local quenching in the region of the decaying holmium atom, and it's very difficult to understand the resulting spectrum. You can also incorporate the rhenium into a dielectric, but this gives an untenably long response time. And combined with a low specific activity, a larger scale experiment looks impractical, and that community has essentially all moved on to holmium-163. An isotope that you wouldn't have heard about 10 years ago is indium-115. So this is a partial level diagram showing the ground and first excited states of indium-115 and its daughter tin-115. And in 2005, it was discovered that the ground state of indium did not decay to the ground state of tin 100% of the time. There is actually a part per million decay branch to the first excited state of tin-115. And the exciting thing about that part per million decay branch is that it has an exceptionally low Q value of only 173 EV. So a huge portion of your spectrum, relatively speaking, is sensitive to the neutrino mass. There's been a lot of activity in this community trying to characterize this decay branch, and their papers tend to mention neutrino mass measurements. The only issue is that this beautiful low Q decay is hidden in the much more common decay branch that has a Q value of 497 keV. Despite some excitement in the indium community, I think I agree with this statement that it's a magnificent challenge. It's fun to think about, but it's hard to imagine a competitive experiment. At this point, having talked about the challenges of rhenium and indium, it's only fair that I talk about the challenges of tritium and holmium. In particular, you need to understand the beta spectrum in order to extract a neutrino mass from a shape distortion near the endpoint. You need some comparison. So when we draw tritium decay in talks like this, we tend to draw isolated tritium atoms, or maybe even nuclei, and all you need to worry about in that case is electronic excitations. But tritium is hydrogen. Hydrogen is reactive. The simplest gaseous tritium source that you can make is a T2 gas. And in this case, you have vibrational and rotational modes that can be excited by beta decay. So the beta spectrum that you have to use in order to extract the neutrino mass depends not only on the excitation energies of these modes, but also on the probabilities that they're excited in beta decay. So fortunately, we have precise ab initio calculations of this molecular final state distribution. It is a two-electron molecule, so it is really a very luckily simple case. The problem is that the theoretical method used does not lend itself to an intrinsic calculation of the theoretical uncertainty. And this enters directly into the analysis which makes experimentalists nervous. One of the aspects that makes experimentalists nervous is historical. So this red line shows the final state distribution as a function of binding energy from a recent theoretical calculation. The blue line shows a calculation from 1985. So you can see what are essentially some artifacts of worse computational power. The blue line was the theoretical spectrum available when the Los Alamos and Livermore tritium experiments were analyzed. Both of those experiments got negative values for the neutrino mass squared. In the Livermore case, very significantly negative. So with some colleagues, I tried to estimate how those values would have changed if they had had the newer red spectrum available, and it looks as though, at least to first order, this would have brought their results positive and consistent with zero. So this underlines the importance of having an accurate spectrum. Katrin's error budget requires an uncertainty at the 1% level on this distribution. So our theoretical colleagues are working on new calculations. The Katrin collaboration is working on a better characterization of the initial molecular states of the source. And there's also an experiment under construction in Seattle to try to resolve a historical discrepancy in the validation of the theoretical model. For holmium, until very recently, a major problem in predicting the shape of the spectrum was uncertainty about the Q value, or the mass difference between the parent and daughter states. So until very recently, there were no direct measurements of the Q value. It was inferred from spectral measurements. And you can see in this plot of the Q value measurements over time that there are some very significant discrepancies depending on measurement techniques. So members of the ECHO collaboration just last year made the first dedicated measurement of the mass difference using a Penning trap. And they have resolved this issue. There's consensus that the direct measurement is going to be the best. This results in a Q value near the top of what had been the expected range. This is a disadvantage because it means there are fewer statistics in the region of interest, but it also turns out to be an advantage for an interesting reason. The standard spectral calculation, the spectrum plots that I've shown you, all assume that there's only one vacancy in the daughter atom, and that's due to the captured electron. But you're also changing the nuclear charge, and you can certainly shake up the electrons of the daughter atom and end up with additional vacancies. So over the last year, there's been a great deal of work on trying to calculate these new resonances, because any structure near the endpoint will make the neutrino mass extraction much more complicated. So we now have some fairly good theoretical calculations of two-hole spectra and two-hole and three-hole corrections to the spectra, and it looks like it's a few percent effect, and partly thanks to the relatively high Q value, it's well separated from the endpoint. That's good news. You also have to worry about exciting electrons to the continuum, which makes this a three-body decay process. This is harder to calculate, but there's been some recent preliminary theoretical work, which finds that this effect actually enhances the statistics a great deal near the endpoint. So that could be an advantage for the experiments, particularly because it reduces the relative contribution due to pileup. The only problem, of course, is that if this is the dominant mechanism near the endpoint, then you need to understand it very well. So there's ongoing theory work in this area with Derukula and Lucignoli leading the charge. The experimentalists in this field also have to-do lists. For Project 8, the collaboration is currently working on transitioning from krypton 83 to tritium, and they are working hard to study various systematics. The homogeneity of the magnetic field in the trapping region is a major potential issue requiring some work, studying the lifetime of electrons in the trap, as well as possibilities of eventually developing an atomic tritium source, which would allow you to skip all of the molecular state issues, molecular final state issues. issues that we discussed. Tritium in general is very challenging, so I'd like to briefly give you a historical example of the Mainz experiment, which used a T2 film on a substrate. So the initial Mainz result for the neutrino mass squared was negative, which generally points to a systematic error that hasn't been accounted for. And when the collaboration did additional analysis, they found that as you made your acquisition window larger, as you widened the region in which you were studying the spectral shape, your neutrino mass squared value got more and more negative. It turned out that the film was de-wetting from the substrate over time, so you had extra energy loss due to the irregular structure. The advantage there is that that's something that you could fix by lowering the temperature, which was very nice for Mainz, but a good reminder for Katrin and Project 8 that there are often unexpected source effects. So for Katrin, there is a gaseous tritium source, so this type of solid state effect should not be an issue for Katrin. But it is also a dynamic source where you're injecting tritium in the center and continuously pumping it out at either end. So there's a great deal of work in monitoring the stability of various operational parameters of the source in order to try to limit the dragons at the edge of the map. Holmium source problems mostly boil down to the difficulty in making holmium. There are two main strategies. ECHO and Holmes go with neutron irradiation of erbium-162 in a large nuclear reactor. This has a very large cross-section, which is good, but results in significant radioactive impurities. So you need some chemical purification both before and after. The NUMEX collaboration has been trying to go the other way on the chart of the nuclides by irradiating dysprosium with protons. This has a fairly small cross-section, which is annoying, but you end up with very few radioactive impurities, so you don't end up needing much chemical purification. Everybody worries about backgrounds. For Katrin, the neutrino mass squared sensitivity goes as the sixth root of the background rate, which is a big advantage of the Mackey filter technique. But in a large Mackey filter, you do get some novel background sources, especially due to radioactive decays inside the volume of the Mackey filter or on the interior surface of the vacuum vessel. For Holmes and ECHO, the worst background source is pileup. So this occurs when you have two events that are not separated enough in time that you can resolve them as separate events. So you end up artificially inflating the measured energy, and that can really complicate the shape of the spectrum near the endpoint, because now you have lower energy events that are showing up. So this is a example simulation. If you have some 10 to the minus 6 a pileup probability, you still end up with some significant structure near the endpoint. And this ends up making the optimization problem for the activity on each pixel a complicated one. You want as few channels as possible, but you also don't want so much activity on the pixel that you can't get a reasonable spectrum. At this point, I'd like to acknowledge KITP for hosting us, the organizers for inviting me, and the direct neutrino mass measurement community in general for giving me many more interesting things to talk about than can fit in 30 minutes. But I think one of the most important things to talk about is what you can expect in the next several years. So at the top, this is what the Katrin sensitivity is, how it is expected to evolve over several months of beam time. On the bottom is how you would expect a holmium sensitivity to evolve as you accumulate more and more statistics. So next month, Katrin expects to achieve a first light milestone, and this doesn't mean tritium, but it does mean sending electrons down the entire length of the experiment, which is a 70-meter beamline, and detecting them at the other end. So that will be very exciting. At the same time, this year, Project 8 is working on finalizing and finishing the krypton 83M measurements. Next year, Katrin expects to start taking tritium data. Holmes will deploy a small prototype array to start taking holmium spectra. And Project 8 will begin working on measuring the T2 spectrum. The year after that, Holmes expects to ramp up to its full design operation. ECHO expects to finish up the operation of their kilobecquerel scale project and begin work on their final sub-EV sensitivity project. So over the next several years, or if you attended a talk like this 5 years from now, then we all hope that Catrin will have achieved its design sensitivity, improving by an order of magnitude over previous limits. Project 8 will have about finished its 2EV target and will be hopefully showing great progress on an ultimate phase with an atomic tritium source that could begin to get to the level where you can resolve the mass splittings. On the holmium side, we'll have NUMEX data that will test the theory of holmium spectra and will test the modeling of microcalorimeter type detectors. We'll have about 1.5 EV statistical sensitivity from Holmes and potentially sub-EV results from ECHO, funding permitting. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to understand the broader impacts of the update of the excitation spectrum and the T2 molecule. Mm-hmm. I was very intrigued by the shift of the negative neutrino mass squared to something more seemly, as it were.
Yes.
And what of the implications for these other experiments? Would you be able, for example, to analyze Catrin over a larger energy window, or do the limitations with this Mach-E object limit that? I just wanted to wonder if it was more than a historical remark, as it were.
Yeah, so it's, I think Catrin's and Project 8's main interest at this level is just making sure that we don't get a negative neutrino mass squared from this mechanism. But in terms of enlarging the acquisition window, that's mostly a choice that's made. You're balancing several different potential problems. So Catrin could potentially limit the acquisition window to a narrow enough band that you're only looking at the electronic ground state of the daughter molecule. And that simplifies things. You still have rotational and vibrational modes, but it's a big simplification. On the other hand, you really want to go deeper in the spectrum so that you can demonstrate to the community that you haven't drawn the line right where you don't understand what's happening. Going deeper into the spectrum increases the rate. Very dramatically, so there's sort of a cubic effect right in the region of the endpoint. So there is a point at which you need to reduce the source activity or redesign the detector, as Thierry described yesterday. That's deeper in the spectrum. But one advantage to widening the acquisition window is also that it makes you less sensitive to backgrounds. And Catrin has discovered some novel background processes with this type of technique that its predecessors weren't quite sensitive enough to describe. So we would like to widen the window. You're welcome.
So, is there any sensitivity to the Fields interference term in Catrin, for example? Has anyone looked at that? As you look deeper in the spectrum, and maybe not?
I don't think anyone's looked at that, so I can't answer that off the top of my head, but I'd be interested in discussing it with you.
Do you know anything about the sensitivity of the proposed Ptolemy experiment to the neutrino masses? I know they're thinking about atomic tritium, and I know it's further off, but some of the techniques are similar. So
right. So it's difficult for an outsider to comment on this because Ptolemy's main stated physics goal is a relic neutrino mass measurement, as opposed. So the idea of a relic neutrino mass measurement, I think Thierry talked about this a little bit, is that in a sensitive spectral measurement like this, that you should see a little peak above the endpoint. Displaced by two neutrino masses, essentially, that represents the energy spectrum of inverse beta decay reactions where you've captured relic neutrinos on a tritium target. Ptolemy has not, it's very much in an early design stage, as you mentioned. The idea is that you have a huge amount of atomic tritium that's essentially captured on graphene sheets. And then those go into a Mach-E filter related technology for some initial energy filtering before they pass through a region where you have RF antennae to see the cyclotron frequency, and then cryogenic calorimeters at the far end. So there's been a lot of progress, particularly on the source end, in trapping tritium on graphene and demonstrating that that is possible. But I think that the collaboration is still too small to really study in detail or prototype the rest of the beamline that will be necessary. That's a very long way of saying that I don't know.
Do you have any idea what happened in these older Q value measurements, some of which also claimed a very small uncertainty?
For holmium. So I think there is a lot of curiosity about this question. And I think that there's no consensus. It's clear that there is some systematic effect in measuring these spectra in storage rings and extrapolating to get an endpoint, but there's no consensus on what that systematic effect is.
I know it's early on in Project 8, but could you comment on what might be the ultimate limiting sensitivity in Project 8? Especially if they get with atomic tritium?
So for molecular tritium, the ultimate limit is sort of 0.1 EV, because that's the point at which the broadening due to the molecular effects is just inescapable. If atomic tritium can be achieved, then I'm going to let Ben answer this question.
Further questions?